Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Carol Zaleski, co-author, along with Philip Zaleski, of the book The Fellowship, The Literary Lives of the Inklings, J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S. Lewis, Owen Barfield, Charles Williams. Carol, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay, well, I'm professor of world religions at Smith College, which is a liberal arts college in Massachusetts, a single-sex women's college. I've been here since 1989. I was originally hired for a position in philosophy of religion, but because of my eclectic interests, ended up with a chair as professor of world religions. So I continue to do philosophy of religion, world religions, and a variety of things, and along with that, write very often together with my husband, whom you mentioned, Philip Zaleski, my co-author.
Well, as a professor of religion, specifically world religion, on the surface, you wouldn't seem like someone who would undertake a biography of what was really a mid-20th century English literary group. What led you to write this book?
Well, you know, that's true. I started out mainly in medieval studies. But then because the person I was working with in graduate school left and I was sort of intellectually orphaned, I started to work with people whose interests were more modern. In particular, I got to be a student and fan of William James. So that brought me into the 19th century from the 12th to the 19th. I just jumped over some centuries there. But as a medievalist, I was very attracted to Tolkien and C.S. Lewis. They're both scholars of medieval literature and language and thought. So there's a connection there. But I think also it was an interest that goes back to childhood, especially for my husband, actually. I'm not sure I actually read these people until I was in college, but my husband read them as a child. And so for us together, coming up with this book idea, it was a way to express our gratitude to these authors who had given us a fair amount of enchantment in our lives, as well as connecting to our intellectual interests.
I have to say that it is interesting that background you reference, because when you these four people in particular that you focus on in this book, this group biography, they represent such a wide range of intellectual interests. We're talking about early modern literature. We're talking about romantic poetry. We're talking about Anglo-Saxon literature, and that, of course, you know, is even before we start getting into the books for which they're most famous: the Hobbit, the Chronicles of Narnia, mm-hmm. the Lord of the Rings trilogy. It would seem that you would need to have such a wide, very eclectic background to really, you know, talk about the various aspects that are at play here. When you're not just talking about any one of them, but you're talking about the four in particular that you've focused on.
Well, yeah, it's true. One way to get that kind of wide range of interests and engagement is simply to read these people, because they are all have tremendous catholicity in their tastes and in their erudition is. All you have to do is just read every book C.S. Lewis ever read, and you have a complete education in the humanities, at least in the humanities. But, you know, I think it, I don't think it's accidental that people that, that love Tolkien and Lewis often end up discovering these other members of their literary circle and also end up discovering their predecessors, authors like George MacDonald, the Scottish religious writer and fairy tale writer, or G.K. Chesterton, or some of the other people that there's something going on there. There's a gestalt to this group. So despite the wide range of periods they deal with and styles of writing, they have a lot in common, which would be, at this point, I think, after spending so many years reading their works and learning about them, it's very, what they have in common just really jumps out to both my husband and me. So I can speak about that if you like, or we can move get to that later, if whatever you prefer.
Well, let's talk a bit about the individuals themselves and their early years. And I think the rest will come out as we get into the biographies, because it certainly does it within your book. You really, you know, flesh them out over the course of it. But I was wondering if you could start by taking us back to the beginning. I mean, who was Tolkien? Who was Lewis? Who was Barfield? And what started them on the careers where they would end up working together, discoursing, commenting on their writings during that very critical period when these intellects really come together in a very magical way.
Right. Well, one thing that brings them together, of course, is Oxford. So Oxford is almost like a character in their story. And Oxford is the intellectual center of Britain, along with Cambridge and the Red Brick Universities. I mean, it's not just one center, but Oxford has a kind of special symbolism in a way, a special interest for people who are drawn to the Middle Ages, not just as scholars, but as there's a kind of romantic interest in medieval culture that you find exemplified, for instance, in the Pre-Raphaelites of William Morris, you know, that those sort of figures. So so that's getting back to what they all have in common. But if we wanted to start with Tolkien, he could be described as a scholar of Old English, Anglo-Saxon culture, Old English language, all the Germanic languages, really. A philologist. He did groundbreaking work on Beowulf. How did he come to this? We have to talk about his war experience. Mm-hmm. Well, we could start with his childhood, if you like.
Let's start with his childhood. I was thinking the war is something that might warrant a separate examination, because it's, even before we talk, in addition to Oxford, it is sort of a common theme for so many of them. Obviously, it was a generational experience. But it's one that, you know, obviously influences their lives in so many ways before they formally come together.
Right.
So maybe we should start with their childhoods and then talk about the
war. So we've got to get Tolkien from Southern Africa, Bloemfontein, Orange Free State. We've got to get him from there to Oxford. So there's going to be some traumas along the way that really shape him. So he was born in Southern Africa, where his father was working. And so Bloemfontein was then the capital of the Orange Free State. But because the climate was very difficult, his mother brought him to England. And then his father became ill and died. So he lost his father quite young. And he and his mother and his brother Hilary stayed in England. They moved to a little hamlet called Sarehole outside of Birmingham. Tolkien was educated by the Oratorians, which is a Catholic religious order that was actually brought to the British Isles by John Henry Newman. His mother had converted to Catholicism and brought her two little boys along with her. But she died young from diabetes. Tolkien was always convinced that what really killed her was that her family ostracized her for becoming Catholic. So he harbored both a deep-seated loyalty to his Catholic upbringing and a sense of somewhat of being under siege as such. So his education continued under the guardianship of one of the Oratorian priests, Father Francis, and he was living in a boarding house, but eventually he was basically adopted by Father Francis. He went to a very excellent school called King Edward School in Birmingham, and he made some friends there that are kind of like a foreshadowing of the Inklings. One of the characteristic features of the Inklings as a circle is strong male bonding. It is an all-male society. And so his first experience of that was with a group that named itself the Tea Club and Barovian Society. They were very idealistic young men who had an aspiration to write poetry, to kindle beauty that would recover the culture, kind of save the world. They had a sense of the world being under a cloud, a fallen world, and that through art it could be redeemed. But then the First World War comes. Tolkien served in the trenches in the infamous Battle of the Somme. If you've read The Lord of the Rings or if you've seen the films, the dead marshes in The Lord of the Rings is pretty much based on the landscapes that he experienced during trench warfare. All but one of Tolkien's friends was dead by the year 1918. So that's so the loss of his father, the loss of his mother, a certain sense of isolation in his Catholicism, and then the catastrophe of the Great War and the loss of his friends and the breaking of the fellowship, so to speak, of this society. So all these losses. And then he became, you know, very sensitized to what was happening just to the landscape in England, that what industrialization was doing to the landscape was a kind of a war too, a kind of siege also. So the landscapes that he loved were falling victim to progress and to things like what he called the infernal combustion engine. His mother had instilled in him a great love of language and also of art. She was quite an amazing person herself. So he drew a lot of pictures as a young person and began to invent rudimentary languages. Later on, that would become a major theme of his work, if not an obsession for him. He came to think that all this destruction of the landscape, of culture, and simply death everywhere, the death of all these young men who were so promising, meant that there was something he was called upon to do as one of the surviving members of this youthful poetic fellowship. He had a real sense of a vocation that he had to carry the torch for the other members of his little brotherhood. And to do something about how the England he loved was passing away. So what could he do about that? He had two kinds of skill sets, you might say, that he could bring to bear on this catastrophe. And one was his talent as an artist, especially a kind of visionary artist. He started out doing some realistic artwork, but generally speaking, his artwork is on the fantastic level, but also as a storyteller and as someone in love with language. Actually, I think that's three things, isn't it? Language, a mythopoeic imagination, a storytelling imagination, and a visual imagination that he thought could in some way be part of a collective effort to repair this culture that had suffered so much and that where there'd been so many ruptures. So when he started to become interested in medieval studies, one of the things that was really motivating and connected to his sense of loss and was of course his study of the Norman conquest. So the year 1066, which led to the cutting off of the development of Anglo-Saxon language and culture. So what he wanted to do was in some way recover that lost past as a scholar and then as an imaginative writer as well. That's pretty much Tolkien summed up.
Theme that you mentioned of cultural defense is something that you see in a different way in C.S. Lewis as well, in so many ways.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about his early years and his wartime experience, and then his development, the degree to which was it similar to Tolkien's? Did he come at it from a very different perspective? What brought him to that point in the interwar period where his life and Tolkien start to intertwine?
Yeah. So Lewis is Ulster background, Northern Ireland, Belfast region. So that's a very different background. His family was connected to the Church of England in Ireland, so to speak. And he grew up together with his older brother, Warney or Warren Lewis. They also had early indications of a desire to create fantastic other worlds to live in. So they used to create these lands. Lewis had one called Animal Land, and his brother Warney had a land called India, and eventually they combined them and called them Boxen. Lewis also was shaped by an early loss, the death of his mother, and resulting estrangement, sadly enough, from his father, who was himself quite a character. He's a police court solicitor, very argumentative, very, very eccentric, and actually mercilessly sent up by Lewis in Lewis's autobiographical writing. Lewis was sent to boarding schools in England, and because really the family kind of saw itself as English. These are Anglo-Irish people, like Yeats, for instance, but without as much of a desire to connect to the Celtic heritage. So he was sent to boarding school. He left behind a memoir called Surprised by Joy, which talks about his ordeals in boarding school, being beaten and learning to try to be part of an in-crowd, which he came to think is one of the kind of original sins of humanity. So while he was enduring the hardships of his boarding schools, and he did have one really insane master who ended up being institutionalized right after Lewis left that school. He kind of retreated into an inner world where he had, a sense of possible renewal through contact with imaginary worlds. So that could come to him through reading Milton's Paradise Lost. Another source for him was Beatrix Potter's Squirrel Nutkin. He says it gave him the idea of autumn. All these things spoke to him in some way that was hard for him to articulate, but later on he referred to it under the name of joy, a sense of longing for something beyond the confines of the world he was living in, whether it was boarding school or some kind of just drab industrial setting.
So,
shaped by early friendships. Yeah, go ahead.
So I was going to say, I mean, Tolkien and Lewis are both very familiar figures to us, but then you also talk about these other two names who are featured in your title, Owen Barfield and Charles Williams, and they're not quite as commonly known today as they might have been. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain a bit more about who they were and their contribution, because early in the book you set up how each of them brings something slightly different to the group. And while we might tend to focus upon the achievements of Tolkien and Lewis because their writings are so omnipresent today, you know, Barfield and Williams were both very important figures in their own right, and especially fascinated by Williams because it seemed like in some ways in the 1930s and in the early 40s, he seemed to outshine some of them in terms of the exchange that the Inklings were having.
Yeah, so Barfield, he's a very interesting character. He lived actually until 1997, so almost 100 when he died. So he was, he met Lewis in 1919, I believe, when he came to study in Oxford. He was a member of a movement or participant in a movement called Anthroposophy, founded by the Austrian philosopher and kind of visionary figure Rudolf Steiner. He was very attracted to Romanticism, wrote about Coleridge, and was, like Tolkien and Lewis, really interested in the power of words, of language, and the history of language. He had a theory, actually, that if you studied the history of language, sort of traced back, looking at etymologies and word forms, that you could actually map the evolution of human consciousness, that the history of language is the history of consciousness, and that there have been some radical changes in human consciousness that are registered if you go back far enough and look at language. So, for instance, the word, the Greek word that is often translated as spirit, noema, I believe the word sneeze is etymologically related to it. It combines ideas of breath and wind and spirit. So what a lot of theorists of language would say was that, originally you had these words that meant breath or wind, and eventually they got interpreted in terms of, or they got overlaid with some kind of spiritual significance. And then the spiritual significance became the predominant one. But Barfield really believed that there was a time when in humanity, all of these meanings were one. There was a kind of union of all of them, and there was no distinction between the material and the spiritual, and that there was a sort of catastrophe in which the two got separated, and his hope was that in some way we could integrate them again with the advantages of our sophisticated knowledge that we have now. He wrote a book called Poetic Diction, which was a big influence on the other Inklings, because it looked at language in this way as a kind of living force in culture and not simply as a mode of tool of communication. He was also a dancer, and hoped to have a philosophical career. He wasn't quite as successful, partly for financial reasons. He didn't have the freedom. He had to keep working as a solicitor just to make ends meet. But he was he was Lewis's first adult friend, and before the Inklings even existed, he and Lewis and Barfield and others used to go on these great walking tours where they would discuss, debate, recite poetry, argue about metaphysical questions. So he's important in that way, and in other ways.
And the four, with last, you have Williams, and Williams was, one who probably, he had the shortest life. And in that respect, he also has, he doesn't have quite the same body of literature, which sustains his memory today in the minds of most readers. But he also was a very fascinating personality. And he seems to come into the group almost, sideways in some ways, because he doesn't have quite the same academic background. It's a little bit different.
Yeah, he's fascinating. So Lewis introduced him to the Inklings, and Tolkien had somewhat mixed feelings about him. But actually, I would say that Charles Williams was the one more than any of the other Inklings to make the idea of fellowship, like the Fellowship of the Ring, or we could say the Fellowship of the Inklings themselves. It's also where we got our title for the book from, to make that an explicit principle of theology and of criticism. So I should say a little bit about him because he's not as well known. One way he differed from Tolkien is his love of the city. He was born in London, which would then henceforth be known simply as the city. His father was a clerk who had wanted to be a writer but had visual problems that led to them moving out of London, the city, which would become kind of a mythical place for Williams, kind of like it was for William Blake. So they opened a little stationery shop, the family did, and lived there on really near poverty, very impoverished means. But the father gave Charles a kind of a homeschooling experience, a very wide-ranging literary and imaginative education. And he was brought up in the Church of England, but his father encouraged Charles to read eclectically, even to read atheist tracts, you know, not to close his mind against other possibilities. So Charles did not have, as you said, the academic career that Lewis or Tolkien had, but he did get a scholarship to University College London and commuted there from home. But then he had to drop out because of financial problems, got a job in a bookshop, a Methodist bookshop, and then eventually from there, he got a job at Oxford University Press, which is where he spent the rest of his life working for them. So the headquarters of Oxford University Press were in London, but during the war, they moved their headquarters to Oxford. So the thing about Williams is he lived in a completely mythic world. He would write these plays in which everybody, all his co-workers would become these sort of mythical figures. He called his boss Caesar. He gave everybody names. Sometimes they were all parts of King Arthur's court. He had this tremendous sense of kind of courtesy and magic. He eventually got involved in A.E. Waite's Magical Society. This is A.E. Waite was an important Anglican magician or Anglican with an interest in perhaps some of the people who know about tarot cards have come across a deck that was designed under the influence of A.E. Waite. I've skipped ahead a little bit, but he had a platonic love affair with a co-worker that was kind of like his Beatrice, like Dante and Beatrice. In fact, he wrote a fantastic book about Dante, focusing on the figure of Beatrice, called The Figure of Beatrice. He was kind of a Platonist. In fact, one of his novels, he wrote a group of novels that C.S. Lewis referred to as supernatural shockers. They all had magical elements in them. And one of them, the Platonic archetypes come to Earth and wreak havoc until by some magical means they're called back up to their origins. Actually, the way Lewis and Williams met and what led to Williams being invited to join the Inklings was that when Oxford University Press was evacuated to Oxford from London, one of the manuscripts that came into Williams' lap was the proofs of a book by C.S. Lewis called The Allegory of Love, which is Lewis's first major book, actually, work of medieval scholarship that focuses on courtly love and also on the allegorical imagination. Very fascinating book. William saw the manuscript. He loved it. He said, this is my, you know, kind of romantic theology, as he called it. And just as he was writing to Lewis, he got a letter from Lewis praising his novel, the one about the Platonic archetypes coming to Earth. So it was like they almost crossed in the mail, these letters. So they immediately became really close friends. Lewis and Tolkien had been, well, you know, Lewis had all these sort of best friends. He was best friends with a friend from his Belfast boyhood. He was best friends with Barfield. He was best friends with Tolkien. And now he was also best friends with Charles Williams. And Tolkien was a little bit jealous because Tolkien didn't have all these best friends. He and Lewis were really, Lewis was really the key friend for him. So that when Lewis died, Tolkien said it was like an axe to his roots. Anyway, so Williams came into the fellowship, bringing with him the Famitin into the Inklings, which was just a club. We haven't said that, have we? What was the Inklings?
I was actually going to say, but by the time Williams comes into the picture, the Inklings are a formed group. I was wondering if you could take us back and explain how it was they came together and what purpose the Inklings initially served for them.
Right. So the Inklings. It's a tongue-in-cheek name for a club. Clubs were a really big deal, and I think in academic settings, universities, in cities, it's just a British thing. And we hear about clubability. Actually, when Tolkien first went off to Oxford to begin his undergraduate education at Exeter College, he was famous for joining every club that existed. Well, there was a club that had been founded by another student called the Inklings. And it was a pun, combining the idea of having an inkling about something and making little ink blots that is trying to write. So Lewis and Tolkien, who had also been part of a club together studying Icelandic language and mythology, group called the Kolbiters, joined this Inklings club. And then when the guy who founded it graduated, they just kept it going. And Lewis especially was kind of the hub of it and the main person who would invite others to join. So this group would meet together. This is by the time this started, Lewis was an Oxford Don at Magdalen College in Oxford. They would meet in his rooms once a week, and then another day a week they would meet at a pub, usually pub called the Eagle and Child, nicknamed the Bird and Baby. So when they would meet in Lewis's rooms, they would read out loud to each other works that they were writing, works in progress, and they would criticize them, and they would drink and have a pretty wonderful, uproarious time. If anybody else criticized the works of fellow members of the Inklings, they would close ranks to defend them. An example of that was when Lewis started writing what came to be called the Space Trilogy. He wrote this book called Out of the Silent Planet. Tolkien had a lot of criticisms of it. Tolkien was the only one who really created a completely, fully realized imaginative universe. No one before him, no one since him, no one within this circle came anywhere close to that. So he had a very high bar for what a good fantasy or mythopoeic piece of literature would be like. And what Lewis was writing, which he would just sort of dash off, never quite satisfied Tolkien. But when an outside reviewer wanted Out of the Silent Planet to be rejected, Tolkien wrote to the publisher and said, "This guy is an obvious idiot. And he just doesn't understand. He doesn't understand angels. He doesn't understand imaginative cosmologies. He doesn't understand anything medieval." The Inklings was this kind of fellowship of all for one, one for all in some ways, but also mutual criticism, which really, I think, improved their work. If it hadn't been for the encouragement, too, that that Tolkien received, we wouldn't have a Lord of the Rings. He was reading that aloud at Inklings meetings.
One of the things I thought you'd do in the book that was really interesting was you look at what each of them brings to it intellectually. And here we're talking, you've already talked about their Tolkien's academic background, Lewis's academic background, Barfield's academic background, but you also get into their beliefs and their faiths, and you point out how different they are, and in maybe a global spectrum, it wasn't that different. We're talking about people who are generally, believers, non-believers in a Christian God. And yet they are bringing within that context, different perspectives on. They're not a shared group of like-minded people in the sense they all think the same way. They have different perspectives, and you delve into that. I thought that was very fascinating. What do you feel in particular, each one of them brought to these exchanges in terms of that religious worldview, that intellectual perspective, and how might we see that reflected in some of the works that these writers are producing during this period?
Right. When you talk about the religious point of view, where there's both a shared perspective and differences, I mean, it somewhat comes down to denominational differences, I suppose. Tolkien, as I've mentioned before, was an ardent Catholic going back to his mother's conversion. Lewis was Anglican. Once he became Christian, he describes the whole process of his conversion in the memoir, Surprised by Joy. He went through various stages of atheism, skepticism, occultism, trying out different kinds of spiritual paths, and ended up Christian. He figured that he should just be part of his national church, just be an ordinary, British Christian, which meant Church of England. It was really important to Lewis to be able, when he started to write works of Christian philosophy and reflection, that he should be able to speak to Christians of all sorts. But Tolkien suspected Lewis of harboring some anti-Catholic prejudice, going back to his own Ulster background and to the conflicts in Ireland. In fact, Tolkien referred to that as Lewis's ulterior motive. Ulterior motive. So Lewis is an ecumenically minded Anglican. Tolkien is a devout and very old-fashioned and conservative Catholic. When the changes happened from after the Second Vatican Council, I think it was his grandson heard him at Mass shouting out the responses in Latin when everybody else is using English. Tolkien had a very strong sense of the sacraments. Tolkien's not interested in writing theology or apologetics, as Lewis came to do. Barfield, as I mentioned, was a member of this Society of Anthroposophy, which was a kind of Christian mysticism, but not wholly Orthodox. Charles Williams was a member in good standing of the Church of England, but he was also involved in various magical practices. It's hard to define that. So they're all different in that way, but they all have Christianity in common, and they all have the sense that that this world is a fallen world, and yet not a forsaken world, that it's a world that will be redeemed, and that to some extent they're called upon to either to collaborate in or perhaps just to respond in some way to the ongoing remaking, renewing of the world. So if you think of it in terms of the Shire, at the very end of The Lord of the Rings, is destroyed, but there's also hope for its renewal. So they have that in common. They really are in some ways a kind of late stage romanticism. They have that in common too. Their love of medieval literature and culture, their love of fairy, of the whole, fairy as a place, and of fairy tales within that place. You could associate them in some ways with Wordsworth and Coleridge and even William Blake, but unlike the original romantics or the first couple generations of romantics, there's no sense in them of wanting to rebel. They're all, in one way or another, trying to be within the mainstream of classical Christianity. None of them are atheists, certainly. We don't have any Shelleys there, but they do have a lot in common with the Romantic movement. They all love language. They all think language is powerful, has a sort of cosmic metaphysical power to it. They all believe in the power of storytelling, which is, it sounds kind of trite, because, you know, everybody loves stories. But in terms of literature, they were definitely marching to a different drummer when you think about different kinds of modernist movements that were going on in the sort of highbrow circles of Oxford, Cambridge, London, and so on. Tolkien once said, you know, these sort of modernist readers hate my work, but that's okay. I have no interest in theirs. You know, just that kind of realistic, but, you know, impeccably styled writing just was just not their cup of tea. So they have that in common too, that they're interested in stories of the kind that you find in fairy tales rather than in very finely nuanced psychological depictions, like Mrs. Dalloway, things like that, which are brilliant, you know, but they just, that's just not their thing at all. So they make common cause against modernism in literature, against modernity in terms of its negative side, its, you know, industrialization, dehumanization, war, environmental catastrophe. For them, being medievalists in a way as scholars is also being medievalists of the romantic sort, kind of wishing that we could recapture some of that worldview and way of life.
And yet for, you know, all of that sort of regret about the, you know, modern world, if you will, that they're so very much part of it. I thought that especially came through when you're talking about World War II, because you have this other conflict, and rather, and there, especially when you're talking about the relocation of the OUP headquarters to Oxford, that there's a sense that they really, you know, they could have sat there and retreated from it. They could have treated Oxford as sort of a very, you know, genteel funk hole, but instead they're very involved in what's going on with it. They're very much engaged with the world. You described Lewis has this very remarkable rise during this period to becoming this is the period where he really emerges as this foremost Christian apologist in the English speaking world. So how does the war kind of, if you will, crystallize the Inklings in a way, and also help to give them greater stature, and while at the same time, you know, also unfortunately in the case of Williams, start to shrink their circle as well.
So it's really the First World War that is the important war to think about in terms of at least Lewis and Tolkien. They were both at the front. They both saw lots of death and lost friends. They both experienced Oxford when it was basically given over to be barracks. That was at an age too that was so formative for them. During the Second World War, they were too old to serve at the front. So they had different roles. And as you mentioned, Lewis in particular had acquired a whole new public voice during the Second World War. What happened was Lewis became Christian in the early 1930s. He decided to do a little bit of writing about that. He wrote an allegorical piece. It's not one of his best works, called The Pilgrim's Regress. So a kind of version of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, which has got a lot of satire in it of the sort of cultural follies of the time. It's not great, but it's interesting. An editor was intrigued by it and asked Lewis to write for a series of books on Christian themes, a little book talking about the problem of evil and of pain. That became the book called The Problem of Pain. And that launched him. So then during the Second World War, when radio was a really important way of raising spirits, of marshaling energy, Lewis was invited to give these sort of 15-minute talks on Christianity. And those are the talks that became published later, eventually, as the book Mere Christianity. At that time, it was said that his was the second most recognized voice. You know, people would hear it and know who it was, next to Winston Churchill. And there was a certain amount in common in the sense, I mean, all of them, actually. When Tolkien's writing about the hobbits, these sort of brave little ordinary, just really ordinary people, but when the Shire is attacked or when their values are attacked, they're incredibly stubborn and amazingly resilient and strong, as no one would suspect. That's sort of Churchill, what Churchill's trying to convey and inspire about the British people comes across in Tolkien's Hobbit. But the First World War had a greater, a more profound influence, I think, on Tolkien's imagination in the Second World War. So Lewis became then the public voice of Christianity, and has remained in many ways to a great extent, has remained that. It was not something that Tolkien was all that fond of, actually, that Lewis was doing that. Tolkien didn't really, well, one thing Tolkien hated was using fiction to make a sort of didactic appeal, you know, to convert people. He said, he called that allegory. I think that allegory has a number of different meanings, but in the sense that Tolkien despised it, there's a sort of thing Lewis was doing with the Chronicles of Narnia. It was just too obvious, the Christian message. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, Tolkien felt that if, you know, he writes as a Christian, he tells his dear friend, the priest who actually just recently died. He tells him that the Lord of the Rings is a fundamentally Christian and Catholic book, but that message is deeply submerged in it. It's not obvious. It doesn't hit you over the head. It's not like you have point for point correspondences. You might have some Christ figures, but they kind of keep changing. Who's the Christ figure changes. But Lewis was willing to present his Christian worldview in a very clear, basic, simple, you know, 15-minute sound bites, and also in a kind of transparently in his fiction.
Now, we've been talking about these four figures here and how they come together and they support each other and they critique each other. But as you explain in the book, it's not just those four. That there are other people that come mm-hmm. in, like Tolkien's son. You mentioned, you know, other people like Dorothy
Sayers. Yeah, who just both. Died.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes, I know.
Yeah.
Did you have a chance to speak to him for the book before I passed?
No, we didn't, actually, although we certainly benefited from his work. We were just hoping that the Tolkien estate would allow us to use a lot of this material. And as it turned out, they were very, very good about that. But we had been warned that it might not be easy. So we didn't communicate with him personally, because by the time that we were doing this book, he had actually retired from his work in the Tolkien estate. So we just dealt with the Tolkien estate. But we certainly admire him. I mean, without Christopher Tolkien, so much of his father's mythology would be lost. And also so much of our understanding of what went into the making of The Lord of the Rings. We have the 12-volume History of Middle Earth, which has drafts of different aspects of The Lord of the Rings, and then we have the Silmarillion, which is the original work that Tolkien did, which began when he was in the trenches, actually, mm-hmm. Creating what he called a mythology for England, a kind of imagined ancient past for England that would also in some ways be diagnostic of and creative in England trying to find itself again. It would be also, of course, with many universal themes. So he was starting to create this whole cosmology, and when he was in the trenches, and then it was his lifelong dream to publish it, but it really never caught the attention of publishers. They always thought nobody's going to want to read this. So he had written a children's book for his, just for his kids, The Hobbit. You know the story of how The Hobbit got started?
Could you relate it for those who might not be familiar with it?
Yeah. He had to take on sort of academic piecework to help support his family. So in the summers, he would grade examination papers. It was really grunt work, really pretty dreadful. But he had to do it as the paterfamilias to support his growing family. So one day he was grading these papers, and on one paper had a blank page on it. And he was so happy to see the blank page. He just started writing something. And what he found himself writing was, in a hole in the ground, there lived a hobbit. So this is his version of it anyway, which he's told in many venues. He didn't know yet what the hobbit was, but he turned it into a story for his kids. And they loved it. And it eventually got published. So then and it was a tremendous success. So the publisher wanted a sequel to The Hobbit. And Tolkien tried to write the sequel. It took him 12 years to create what would become The Lord of the Rings. The thing was that he had this mythology that he was working on, and he wanted to publish that. He couldn't interest the publishers in it, but he found that it kept kind of creeping into this sequel to The Hobbit, which he would be reading at Inkling's meetings, and they were just calling it, you know, the Hobbit sequel. You know, at the end of The Hobbit, it says that Bilbo remained very happy to the end of his days. He had to figure out how to create a sequel. So in order to create a sequel, he had to have other characters come into play. Couldn't be Bilbo going off on another adventure. So as he started to work on the Hobbit sequel, it became less and less like a children's book. It became darker. So for instance, he ended up revising The Hobbit so that it would fit better with The Lord of the Rings later. But in the original version of The Hobbit, Bilbo had stumbled upon a magic ring that confers invisibility. He could use it to get through various difficult situations. And so in Tolkien's notes, as he's trying to create what would become The Lord of the Rings, he writes, "Not very dangerous when used for a good purpose." So obviously he's like, he changed his mind about the ring. There's a figure called the Necromancer who becomes the Dark Lord Sauron, who's the maker of the Rings of Power and wants to, you know, is planning to conquer Middle Earth, which is just a part of this Earth, by means of this master ring. And then all these other beings started to come in from Tolkien's great myth that he was working on. So the elves, the high elves, the orcs and the Uruk-hai and the Ents and the wizards, the Astari and Gandalf. The Lord of the Rings grew that way. With the encouragement of C.S. Lewis, without whom it would certainly not have seen the light of day.
This one of the points of the book I thought was especially fascinating, because the Inklings are, as a group, survived the war, and they continued writing. But as they are gathering, there by this point, you know, The Hobbit comes out in 1938. Lewis has gained his stature during the war. So after the war, they're still coming together, but now they have this aura around them, and they have this fame, which is drawing a lot of people to them. How did the Inklings survive this? At what point did they not survive it any longer? And what ultimately was the fate of the key individuals involved in the Inklings group?
Well, the major celebrity status for Tolkien was really in the 60s. So it wasn't so bad right at the beginning. I think it was still, you know, possible to think of the Lord of Rings as a kind of, as people would say, the work of a professor at play. So a lot of people appreciated it, but he wasn't a rock star. But he became a rock star in the hippie era, when, you know, hippies would come over from the States, you know, and try to, you know, climb into his garden and take a look at him and try to get pictures and things like that. So, and that was pretty awful for him. So, yeah, he just simply tried to dodge it as much as he could. Lewis, on the other hand, I think the major form that his celebrity took was in the form of letters that he would get from fans, and very often letters asking for spiritual advice, sometimes letters asking for financial help, which he actually respond to. He responded to every letter. He had help from his brother, Warney, who sort of acted as the secretary. But it was really extraordinary. I mean, I have a hard time keeping up with letters from, and he just, it would answer everybody's letter, and sometimes at great length, and you know, end up becoming like a, almost like a spiritual director to some of the people that that wrote to him. And he had Owen Barfield, who was his solicitor, set up a special fund for his royalties to be deposited into, which would then be used for charity. So that when someone called, you know, wrote to him and said, you know, my husband just left me and I've got nothing. And he would say to Barfield, you know, send some of that money to this person. So, yeah, that would be the main choice. Celebrityhood, not quite so bad in the 30s as it is now, or as it became in the 60s.
And it was especially interesting because as you and your husband point out, by the 1960s, not only is the celebrity growing, but they're actually becoming the subject of academic study. So by so they've actually lived to see themselves become, you know, the sort of groups and works that they themselves had went, at one point studied in terms of previous generations.
Yes, although they had a real prejudice against studying modern literature in an academic format. I think Lewis says something like, you might as well, you know, have a, I'm really paraphrasing, have a professor, you know, teach you about modern literature as have a nurse wipe your nose for you or something like that. He said, you should be able to figure it out for yourself. You don't need, you know, scholarly apparatus to understand a work that's basically contemporary with you. What you should be studying, Lewis and Tolkien agreed on this, and they were part of a kind of faction at Oxford trying to control the curriculum in English literature, is you should be studying this, the stuff that's alien to you culturally, within your own, even if it's within your own tradition of English language tradition, you should be studying Beowulf. You should be learning the Germanic languages, everything that happened before the Norman conquest and after the Norman conquest. That's what you should be studying and writing doctoral theses on and so on. Not, you know, not T.S. Eliot, not Lewis, not Tolkien. But of course, nobody's paying attention to that. So that's definitely how they felt. They finally agreed that it would be okay for this English syllabus to stop at Jane Austen, but not beyond that. And Lewis said, you know, reading old books is a great way to get out of your kind of cultural captivity, to be able to, you know, to break out of a kind of conformity that we're not even that conscious of, to see with other eyes, which he says is basically why we read, the purpose of reading. They all agree, all the Inklings would agree to this. Lewis said that the reason we read is that we want to see with other eyes than our own. We want to feel with other hearts. We want to, he says, we seek an enlargement of our being. That's the purpose of reading. That's the purpose of fantasy. Of, you know, it isn't just some kind of low-grade kind of titillating entertainment to have dragons and magicians and so on. Its purpose is actually similar from reading a treatise by Athanasius, that is, to take you out of your narrow, constricted mindset, enable you to see other possibilities. And then when you return to your ordinary world, suddenly it's enchanted again.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Oh, yeah. A couple of things. I just gave a lecture here at Smith on William James and the making of the varieties of religious experience, and on how James himself, the great American philosopher, psychologist, and his great work on religion are both in a certain sense a kind of unfinished project. So I got really excited about that. I've always been very fond of William James, and I'm thinking about making that into a book. I have another project on immortality, the search for immortality. And then my husband and I, we do a lot of writing together. We've written on prayer and heaven and hell and this book, The Fellowship. We're currently brainstorming about what we want to do next together.
Well, I do look forward to what that project produces, because this was a truly, very excellent, stimulating work on the Inklings.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Carol Zaleski, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.